As someone who's been a victim of credit card fraud, as I have, maybe you have too, somebody was actually paying for a meal in a restaurant not so far from here that is now closed down. Somebody just swiped the card, you know, took the card, swipe it as they do, and then copied it, and then went and bought loads of stuff, which was a bit of a shock when the bill came through. Anyway, as someone who's been a victim of credit card fraud, and maybe you know something about this yourself, I'm always interested to hear about the ways banks are trying to make cards more secure. You know, they talk about doing things like, you know, having the imprint of your iris and things like that, so that you can take money out of the hole in the wall, all those sorts of things. A few months ago, the Daily Telegraph reported on that subject. And the following day, somebody I don't know, but enjoyed his letter to the editor. His name is Tony Rigby from Buckinghamshire. Maybe some of you know him. There are some people here from Buckinghamshire. Well, it's a big county. But anyway, Tony Rigby from Buckinghamshire wrote to the editor, and he wrote this. Sir, you report that Barclays Bank is being forced to review its onerous identification requirements. This brings back a happy memory from my days with Barclays Bank when, as a cashier, I had to ask an elderly customer if she could identify herself. She rummaged in her handbag, produced a mirror and said, "Yes, young man, this is definitely me." He says, "I cashed her check." Well, this lunchtime, as we look at this Bible passage that Jago's just read for us, and I'd encourage you just to have that in front of you. As we look at this Bible passage, we'll find Jesus asking us the same question. Can you identify yourself? Do you know who you really are? And therefore, do you know your greatest need in life? On this occasion that we turn to of Jesus' life, as always, people were flocking to see Jesus. He was such an amazing character. People loved to be around him, hear what he was going to say, wonder what miracle he was going to do next. On this occasion, that included some top theologians from around the country. You can see it there from our opening verse in verse 17, teachers, Pharisees, the religious, top religious boffins of the day. Indeed, as we read on, it seems that the whole town had turned out to see Jesus on this particular day. You can picture the scene, I'm sure, in your mind. Jesus was teaching actually in a house in the town of Capernaum. So many people had turned out to see Jesus that those who hadn't got there early enough were left outside. I always imagine faces pressed up against the windows with their noses bent as they were sort of trying to see what Jesus was doing, trying to hear what he was going to say. And all the while that this was happening, while Jesus was speaking to this huge crowd, Luke tells us there were a group of men trying to get their paralyzed friend to Jesus. Let me read again verse 18 on the blue sheet there. Some men came carrying a paralytic on a mat and tried to take him into the house to lay him before Jesus. When they could not find a way in to do this because of the crowd, they went up on the roof and lowered him on the mat through the tiles into the middle of the crowd right in front of Jesus. Now, do you see what's going on here? These men were desperate to get their paralyzed friend to Jesus to be healed by Jesus. Well, of course they would. If you've been traveling a bit, I was actually speaking to somebody just over lunch about a bit of world travel. If you've traveled a bit, you may have been to the Middle East. I've never been there, but you may have been. And you'll know that many houses in the Middle East have flat roofs with steps outside leading up to the roof. And so these four men carried their friend on the stretcher up onto the roof and promptly set about making a hole in the roof. Who knows what the owner thought? But picture the scene now inside the house. Jesus teaching a capacity crowd, a smaller room than this, I'm sure, fairly dark, lots of people crammed in, standing room only, not even standing room indeed. Jesus teaching a capacity crowd, people hanging on his every word. When all of a sudden, a scratching noise from above, banging from above, bits of ceiling falling in. And suddenly all eyes were on the roof. And as the hole in the roof got bigger and bigger and light began to stream into what would have been probably a relatively dark room, the scene resembled something from a Steven Spielberg movie as this paralyzed man descended out of the sky. As he came down, people shuffled back and the man was lowered right in front of Jesus' feet. Well, after the initial gasp from the crowd, there would have been a hush in the room. All eyes now back on Jesus. What would he say? What would he do? You could hear a pin drop. Jesus looked down at the paralyzed man. The man looked up at Jesus. And then we read verse 20. Aren't these words astonishing? When Jesus saw their faith, he said, "Friend, your sins are forgiven." Sorry? What did you say, Jesus? Your sins are forgiven? What on earth has that got to do with anything? What a disappointment. It's clear what this man needed. He needed his legs to be healed, and here's Jesus going on about sins being forgiven. Can you imagine the paralyzed man's disappointment? If he didn't say it, I presume he thought it. Jesus, never mind my sins, what about my pins? Yeah, no, you don't have to laugh, it's okay. And Jesus, you've missed the point completely. Here you are, supposed to be this great prophet and teacher, but you don't have to be Einstein to know what this man really needs. It's a remarkable moment, isn't it? Doesn't Jesus know what this man wants? Do we have to conclude, after all, that Jesus is only a human after all? Is this the biggest mistake that Jesus ever made? Well, I want to say to you, no, quite the opposite. Jesus knows exactly what he's doing. Because Jesus knows that whatever it looks like, this man's greatest need is that he has his sin forgiven. Now, please, that is not to say that this man's paralysis was not a huge problem for him. Indeed, maybe it was because I was looking at this passage this week. I passed somebody who was in a wheelchair the other day, and I just thought, I'm so grateful that I've got the use of my legs. I really do not want to belittle the struggles that this man would have undoubtedly had because his legs didn't work. He's not to say that Jesus was not interested in this man's physical condition, but Jesus knew that this man's greatest need was to have his sin forgiven all the same. And ladies and gentlemen, that is our greatest need as well, to be forgiven by Jesus. That is our greatest need, because before Jesus, you and I are sinners, every one of us, and that is a very serious condition. Before I became a vicar, I used to work in the newspaper business, and like any other guy in his 20s, I had huge ambition. I wanted to climb the corporate ladder, and the next rung on the ladder was my boss's job. I used to imagine having his company BMW, his job, his office. What a huge office it was, with huge kudos and a great chair as well. From time to time, I imagined being the newspaper sales and promotions manager, occupying that office, sitting in that magnificent swivel chair behind the boss's office, behind the boss's desk. Now, I wanted his job. Not that I'd have ever told him that. He was a scary boss. Bob Priddle was his name. P-R-I-D-D-L-E. Bob Priddle. You didn't mess with Mr. Priddle. And you didn't make jokes about his name either. Well, of course, because he was such a scary man, I never told him that I had an eye on his job and his car and his office and that chair. But one day, at the end of the day, when everyone except the cleaners had gone home, I had to drop a report onto Mr. Priddle's desk so that he'd have it first thing in the morning. And as I went into his office, I found myself with the opportunity to sort of try out the office, to give the chair a test drive. And so I did. I sat down behind the desk, and to be sure that I really felt the part, I decided to pick up the telephone and call a mate. And of course, the chair swiveled back, and as the telephone rang, I put my feet up on the desk. And at precisely the time my friend picked up the phone, Mr. Priddle walked into the office. Oh, said I, why aren't you at home? I mean, I was sounding like his mum. And on reflection, I now realised that I was in no position to be asking him questions, even though I was now sitting in the boss's chair. Indeed, it was then that I decided that I'd become a vicar, as I recall. Or maybe it was then that he decided that I should become a vicar. Well, either way, it was a pretty horrible moment. Now, look, if that was bad for me, and I can assure you it was, can you imagine how bad it would be that one day you and I discover that there we are, bold as brass and as large as life, sitting in God's place, on God's throne. And when he walks in, you and I realize that all our lives we've assumed his position. Can you imagine what the living God would think of us? You see, it's just not right. I am not the moral judge of the universe. I did not create the world. I am not God. And so it's just not right to sit in his seat. And that is what sin is. To live by my rules, to make up the rules as I go along, to say, no, I'm not going to take your word for it, God. I'm going to do it my way. That's sin. And if we can only grasp, only begin to grasp how bad that is, we will begin to see that whatever else is going on in our life, our greatest need is that we're forgiven. The thing is, it never really feels like the most pressing need, does it? I think of some friends of mine. If I was to ask them, what's your greatest need? Think of one of my friends having just been made redundant. She might say that her greatest need is to find a job to pay the mortgage. No small thing. Think of another friend who would openly say that his greatest need is to repair his marriage. I was devastated when he rang me up to say that his marriage had broke. They seem to have such a great marriage. Another would say, undoubtedly, that his greatest need is for someone to find a cure for motor neurons disease, and quick. See, a job, money, relationships, good health. Or maybe we look on a bigger scale, world peace, global warming, poverty, famine. They are all huge and important issues, and I so do not want to say they're not important. I so do not want to belittle the needs of these, my friends. But still, the greatest need is the forgiveness of our sin, because that lasts for eternity. If you have huge worries if you have no huge worries in the world at the moment, you may have listened to the government and financial advisors who suggest that our greatest need is to have financial security, and not least of all a good retirement package. Well, interestingly, I was sitting with somebody who works in those things at the moment. Well, you know, when I think of those things, I think of a widow I met some years ago. I met her just days after her husband had died. I'd been asked to take her funeral. I'll never forget the crushing disappointment on her face as she said to me, "We've saved all our lives for our retirement. Bert worked hard all his life so that we could retire to our dream cottage in the Cotswold. We were so looking forward to moving there." Well, those words are tragic in and of themselves. What is even more tragic is she said those words to me just 1 week after Bert had retired. So having spent all his life working and living for his dream, a cottage in the Cotswolds, just 1 week after his retirement, Bert wasn't standing in the garden of his dream cottage. He was standing before the living God, standing before the creator of all things, the one who'd given him life itself. And he was standing before this one who was someone who, it turned out, he'd barely given a second thought to in the whole of his life. You see, whatever the world may tell us, whatever we may feel, whatever our circumstances, our greatest need is to have made our peace with the living God, to be able to stand before him one day and to hear from Jesus these words that he said to the paralytic, "Friend, your sins are forgiven." Of course, if you're young and healthy and with your whole life before you, if you're not a lead supporter, if you have no real problems, you won't really listen to me when I talk about eternity and meeting God one day as being very important. Death seems so miles away for many of you here. I think it does for most people, no matter what age we are. And even if everything is not in life is not going well for you, as it wasn't for the paralyzed man in our story, the problem of our sin won't seem like the most important thing. And if that's you, then very simply this afternoon, there is a clash of worldviews going on. Jesus is saying, there is a God who's going to judge you, and you are saying, no, there's not. And so I'm standing in the middle and I'm saying, what is reality? Who's right? Well, let's ask the paralyzed man, shall we? You see, there were two amazing things that happened to that man that day. Yeah, Jesus forgave his sin, but later on in the story, we hear that Jesus did heal his legs. Now, just imagine if we could ask the angels in heaven, if we could just hear from that man this afternoon, I wonder what he'd say. Well, I think he'd go something like this. Oh, it's wonderful to be with you here this lunchtime. Enjoyed the meal very much. Thank you, Jack, for that. Oh, and yes, I remember that day very well indeed. My friends persuaded me that we should try and go and see Jesus. We'd heard all about the things he was doing. We'd heard about the amazing miracles that he'd done. And they were convinced that he would heal me if only they could get me to him. But when we got there and the crowds were so dense, you know, I was bottling out and I said to my friends, let's just go home. But they wouldn't take no for an answer. They were certainly persistent, my friends. I couldn't believe it, though, when they took me up onto the roof. And then when they started to dig a hole in the roof, well, I nearly died of embarrassment when they lowered me down through the roof. Everybody was looking at me. And then it all seemed like a total waste of time anyway when Jesus looked at me and said, "Friend, your sins are forgiven." My heart sank. And I thought to myself, you're supposed to be a prophet. You should know I've come to have my legs healed. What's all this about sins being forgiven? Then there was a discussion between Jesus and the teachers of the law. And before I knew it, Jesus said to me, "Get up, take your mat and go home." And the moment he spoke, I felt all the power coming back into my legs. Instantly, I jumped up and I ran out of the place. No one could believe it. Well, I certainly couldn't. But it was true. I could walk. And what a difference it made to my life. For the next 40 years, I lived a normal life. I got a job, got married, had a wonderful family. Not a day went by when I wasn't profoundly grateful to Jesus that he had healed my legs on that day. But now, now I've been with Jesus for 2,000 years in heaven. And that makes my years on earth actually pale into insignificance, even though I had a great life. Now I know. So now I know that the most important thing that Jesus did for me that day was to forgive my sin. Because that lasts forever. That lasts into eternity. I think that's something of what he'd say. And that's the point of this amazing incident. Jesus knows our greatest need is the forgiveness of our sin. Again, let me ask you, do you believe him? Well, you see, you will if you can look at things from the long-term view. Well, why should you believe him? Why should you believe Jesus? And with this I close. Well, you see, apart from the man who was healed, the other main characters in our story are the religious elite, as we saw in verse 17, the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, the theologians. And if the paralyzed man was initially disappointed by Jesus' words to him in verse 20, the theologians were furious. Let me read again verse 20 and reading on. When Jesus saw their faith, he said, "Friend, your sins are forgiven." And the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began thinking to themselves, "Who is this fellow who speaks blasphemy? Who can forgive sins but God alone? Who does this Jesus think he is, forgiving sins? He can't speak like that. That's blasphemy. Who can forgive sins but God alone?" And of course they're right. Because sin is pushing God out, sitting on his throne, taking his chair. Sin is an offense against God. So verse 21, who can forgive sins but God alone? No one. So do you see what is so outrageous about this? Jesus is acting as if he were God. So here's the big question. Is Jesus just a trumped up example of the rest of us? Sitting on God's throne when he has no right to be there. That's what the theologians were thinking. To them, Jesus was guilty of blasphemy. Were they right? Well, it all depends on who Jesus is. That's the issue. Who is this man? And let me put that question to you as we close this evening. Who do you think Jesus is this afternoon? Who do you think Jesus is? Well, verse 22 gives us a hint. Jesus knew what they were thinking. And asked, "Why do you say these things in your hearts?" Without them uttering a word, Jesus knew what these religious leaders were thinking. Well, who then is this who knows my every thought? Have you got it yet? And if you haven't got it, we can set a little exam that Jesus set for the theologians. Look, here they were, PhDs all over the place, PhDs coming out of their ears. So Jesus gave them a test in verse 23. Do you see it there? He says to them, "Which is easier, to say your sins are forgiven or to say get up and walk?" Now that's my kind of exam. I was never any good at school, but I always enjoyed multiple choice because I thought, well, at least I can put something down. Usually, of course, it's four options. Here there's only two. We've already done the 50-50. There's only A and B left. 50-50 chance of passing this exam, A or B. Which is easier to say, verse 23, to say your sins are forgiven or to say to a paralyzed man, get up and walk? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? Even I can get this one right. Imagine the situation this afternoon. Imagine there was a paralyzed man before me right now. I could easily say to him, "Your sins are forgiven." That'd be easy. There'd be no way of checking. You wouldn't know whether it was true or not, and neither would he, because you can't see sins forgiven, can you? You don't know it. But if I said to the paralyzed man in front of me, "Get up and walk," well, then you'd soon know whether I was genuine or not by whether he did or not. It's easy to say your sins are forgiven. And so, verse 24, "That you may know that the Son of Man," which is an expression Jesus uses for himself, "that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins," he said to the paralyzed man, "I tell you, get up, take your mat and go home." And immediately he stood up in front of them, took what he had been lying on, and went home and praising God. And everyone was amazed. Well, of course they were. Nobody had ever seen anything like this before. Do you see the point? Jesus healed the man to prove that he had the right to forgive sins. What an amazing miracle. Immediately, the paralyzed man, up and about, in an instant, bones, muscles, tendons, knitted together, working again. No physiotherapy needed, instantly. It's an amazing miracle. And Jesus performed it to prove who he was, to prove that he has the authority to forgive sin. So who do you think he is? Who is this man, Jesus, who heals the sick, drives out demons, teaches like no one else, knows what we're thinking, forgives sins, heals a paralytic? Who is this man? Jesus claims to be none other than God himself. And of course, if this is true, it gets very personal. Because if this is true, then it really matters how I relate to Jesus Christ. If this is true, it would be a scandal to ignore him. It would be a scandal to sit in his throne in his seat. So it is very serious, but it's also very, very good news. Because if this is true, and I acknowledge it and live by it, then the most wonderful thing can happen. I can know my sin forgiven. Well, I wish I had longer to go on. I really must stop now. Many of you have got to get back to work. I, as a vicar, have got to get back to daytime television. So I must stop. But I would love, if I may, to invite you just to take one of these. It's just a part of what we've been reading, a little bit more of it. Luke's Gospel, one part of the Bible. You'll see it's taken straight from it. It's been in modern language, so you'll be able to understand it. I'd love it if you'd take one of these and then read it. And read about this thing about Jesus forgiving sin. That's really what it's all about. They'll be on the table as you leave. Just pick one up. I'd also love it if some of you are saying, yeah, I do want to know more about this. I want to investigate, is Jesus really who he said he was? And how can I really get this forgiveness of sin? I'm really intrigued. I want to know some more. Well, that's the first step. The second step, I guess, is to come along to Christianity Explored. We run two Christianity Explored courses, one at lunchtime on Wednesdays. It will be here. And the details are on this red sheet. The other, if you can't make lunchtime so easily, Wednesday evenings. We started last night, but it's okay to come next week. You'd be very welcome. I help lead that course, and I'd be there pleased to welcome you. Thanks very much for listening. I'll leave you now to be pressing on. In fact, I'm going to hand back over to Jago. And do grab hold of me if any of you want to talk further about these things.